Part 3, Raconteur. I wondered why, as the center was not poor, we had to put a price on some small tracts kept at the book counter and intended for new inquirers. Swami answered my question with an anecdote. It happened some years before that he was with other tourists at the top of the Empire State Building one day at about noon. Suddenly a woman came up, grabbed him by the wrist, and led him away. Pulling him, too startled to resist, to a microphone, she there informed him that from this moment every word he said would be broadcast. She proceeded to interview him in the usual manner, and when he had explained his profession, asked if any collection was taken at the center, or how otherwise he made his expenses. Swami replied to her that a collection was taken and other donations were made. She appeared astonished and asked how he had become so westernized as to do this. She had thought that all Indian teachers abjured money in exchange for their teachings. Swami, never at a loss, confided, "Well, I'll tell you something. I have found in this country that even a good thing you cannot give away, but even a bad thing, if you sell it, people will take it." He had a fund of stories that was justly famous. It never ran out. Those at his own expense, like the above, were as delightful to him as the rest. When he narrated one of his tales, you laughed till you wept, and not only the first time. Countess was particularly vulnerable, and that was fortunate, for she had more occasion to hear them than others. I wondered if, in the 10 months I was there, he exhausted his repertoire. Perhaps. It did not seem to matter how many times he had told it. If there was one person present who had not heard the story, it would come out. And sometimes even that stimulus was superfluous. It did not matter how well you knew the lines. So funny was Swami in the telling. The anecdote of Alex Mintha in the story of San Michel, the book. His wanting a shave on board ship, where only a mortician's helper was present to give one, was, even in numerous repetitions, far more amusing than the original writing. Quote, "A grouchy person," he used to say, "can never be spiritual. A certain basic contentment must be there." End of quote. There is no question about it at all. He was the most stimulating conversationalist I have known. Swami often seemed to me to be a grown-up naughty boy. I should have to vote him person most fun to live with. Another episode of his early years in New York concerns a dinner party to which a friend had invited him. In after-dinner talk, a lady of the party said to Swami Nikhilananda, "You seem to be a very intelligent man. How does it happen you never became a Christian?" How his eyes would sparkle on telling this. He told serious stories too, of course, like the following incident to which he said Swami Akandananda had been witness. On the day the master gave up his body, he had said early in the day that he would eat 2 eggs, an item unusual for him. They were prepared for him, but in the ensuing events of that dramatic day, the eggs were put aside and he never ate them. After the passing, Naran, Vivekananda to be, said at one point, "Well, I am terribly hungry. What is to be done? Finding those eggs, he ate them on the spot. Swami Akhandananda had felt that with Sri Ramakrishna's lifelong identity with truth, his words were always fulfilled, and this was the way it had to be done, and it showed there was no difference at all between him and Swamiji. Swami Nikhilananda, on hearing that story, had expressed astonishment that Swamiji could have felt hungry at such a time. But Swami Akhandananda replied, "Well, that's the way it happened." With his elder brother monk in the house, Swami Nikhilananda frequently came upstairs and chatted with him in Bengali for hours. I do not suppose the Swami really thought this scholarly and self-sufficient guest could become bored, but he certainly made this appear the one thing most to be dreaded. So he urged him again and again to fix his gaze on the television screen, a thing Swami Madhavananda was at first not at all inclined to do. After all, he had his monastic training and habits, and in India, no such toy. On an evening during this week, Swami Prabhavananda of Hollywood arrived to pay his respects to the old Swami. With him, then, commenced the list of the many visitors who were to honor the distinguished monk. The Swami from California spoke on Sunday to the Vedanta Society across town, while our Swami was giving the service for his own flock at the observance of the thrice blessed day of Lord Buddha. After the service, I happened to meet Swami Nikhilananda on the stairway. There had been the traditional serving to the congregation of payasam, a rice pudding, after the lecture. Swami himself had donned an apron and prepared this sweet for the occasion. "Well, Swami," I remarked, "I have had many kinds of payasam in my Vedantic life, made by various persons, but I have never tasted a better one than yours today." At this he burst out laughing, and before the rest of the household, to general merriment and to my intense discomfort, replied, "He praises my payasam to the heavens, but not a word about my lecture." Before any rejoinder could come to my lips, some temporizing, face-saving remark, he came out with this: "He is thinking, I hear the best lecturing ever, every Sunday in San Francisco. What can I say about his lecture?" Ah, monastic life is indeed a glass house, as Swami Ashokananda was wont to say. This may be a suitable point at which to observe that Swami asked me to go to the Vedanta Society on a Tuesday evening to hear the scripture class of Swami Pavitrananda. He just thought it was the right thing to do, and he sent me in a taxi. Now came the grand day for moving our serene guest to the hospital. Bronson Ray, outstanding brain surgeon of that day, had been engaged through the consultative process. New York Hospital, while not one of the world's largest, certainly looked so to me, and its staff, equipment, food, and privileges seemed superlative. We installed Swami Madhavananda on the 16th floor of the private patient section, which was more like a hotel than a hospital. Room 1620 was the same one Swami Nikhilananda had occupied some years before, during his own bout of surgery. And among the doctors, nurses, and orderlies, some of his old friends remained. Like so many of those acquainted with this popular man, they now sought his company.
Go.
Suddenly, I had to learn my way about town on my own. I would leave the center early in the morning, ride by two bus lines, and arrive to attend the Swami for the morning. Trees were now in leaf, and lawns appeared where no one could have imagined them. From the top of the hospital, it looked as if some great goddess had dropped green lace handkerchiefs all around, embroidered here and there with the pinks and lavenders of azalea bushes. It was necessary now and then to take a taxi. They were at least three-fifths of the vehicles on the street, driving at breakneck speed through the smallest chinks imaginable. Clearance meant literally fractions of an inch. I would close my eyes and take the name of the Lord. There was nothing else to do until the curiosity to see just how narrowly one can miss got the better of me. Space in New York seemed to be worth more than life itself. One day I saw a church used by three different congregations. An ethnic one on Sunday morning, a revivalist in the evening, and an offbeat Jewish congregation meeting on Saturdays. At noon, Swami Nikilananda would come and have his lunch in the cafeteria and let me go home. In the afternoon, the younger Swamis might visit. I would return by 5 o'clock and remain until after 9, sometimes going home with Swami if he had returned. No king or queen, and this hospital had hosted some, could have ever had more attention than this silent, unassuming monk from India. A covey of white-coated doctors was examining him. Dermatologists, neurologists, three or four surgeons. Following the operation, discussed more fully in the next chapter, Swami Madhavananda was even more docile than before. It was difficult to give credence to Swami Nikilananda's private prediction to me that our patient would become more difficult to handle as he recovered. However, he knew what was going on in that mind and saw the resistance to the Swami's plans for attending to all of his disabilities. Swami visited every day, often at evening, with a devotee or two. He would inquire into everything with concern and chat with the older man for an hour or two before we took leave. One night he spoke at length, mostly to Swami Madhavananda, but also for our benefit. I am giving it here as closely as I can remember.
Okay.
Swami Vivekananda, he began, was a man of another plane. We try to put him in our own mold and explain his life thereby, but it is impossible. It is ludicrous. He was entirely of another order. Once two admirers of Swamiji in India were conversing, one waxing very emotional, saying, "Oh, if Swamiji were only here now to see the plight of our country." The other was Holy Mother. She said, "Don't say that. He would have been in jail if he were here today. Things have come to that kind of pass, and I could not have stood it. I just could not have stood it." Swamiji was an unsheathed sword, Swami Nikilananda went on, and how he felt for mankind we just cannot imagine. Once at Balaram Bose's house, he was with Hari Maharaj, Swami Turiyananda, and he just became overwhelmed with man's misery and condition. He wept and wept until his emotion spent itself into a song which he began to sing. You know, people who saw him once never forgot him. One year at Lake George in New York, I was vacationing with Swami Yatishwarananda and Swami Satprakashananda. One day, walking near the lake, I stood for a while until I noticed a young sailor hovering near me. I wondered what he could want. Then he came up and showed me his wallet. In it, his name was printed, and his first name was Ceylon. I forget the last name. He said to me, "My father was also a sailor and went to Ceylon and liked it so much he gave me that name. I don't know much about Indian things. My wife knows more. She reads books on it. Would you like to meet her?" I replied, "Certainly." So he brought her. She had read Raja Yoga and some other books, and was a devotee type. She had had asthma, and by practicing some of the simple breathing exercises, had overcome it. She spoke nicely with me, but she said, "You should meet my mother-in-law, because she met Swami Vivekananda." The mother-in-law was called over. She was a little old lady, over 80, with eyes so bright they looked like coals, and there was a great pride about her. What she said was, "Yes, I went to hear one of Swami Vivekananda's lectures in Chicago at the fair. I was taken by my mother when I was about 16, but I can see him yet. He would stride up and down the platform, and every now and then he would come to the edge of it and look at me. I was sitting right up front. He would emphasize a point and then finish by looking in my face. Much later, I wondered a lot about my religious beliefs and felt very confused about things. At that time, I came across his Raja Yoga, and everything seemed to fall into place." Then, of course, I told her who I was and that we had a center in New York. And when I asked her where they lived, she said, "In Brooklyn." I suggested she come up to our service sometime and gave the address. Then the old lady looked at me with her burning eyes. "Do you think," she said, "anyone who has heard Swami Vivekananda needs to go to anyone else?" A man came to Swamiji, a man who was always getting sick with one ailment or another. He asked Swamiji what he could do about his poor health, and he got this interesting reply: "If you can get to the point where you can say that you have never done anything in your life which you need to regret, then you will always have good health."